Part 3. Biology and Culture. Chapter 7. Making Men. Nature and Nurture Both Matter. Every religion has a story to tell about how or why we're created male and female. In Judaism and Christianity, it all starts with Adam and Eve. Islamic theology teaches that men and women are made in pairs from a single soul. In the Hindu tradition, Brahma asks Rudra to divide into male and female so that creation can continue. These creation stories reflect the most fundamental dichotomy in human biology, the one between male and female. Sex differences in biology shape not only our bodies, including our brains, but also our psychology. We are not blank slates. Some of these differences are more about the timing of development than about the end results. I have already described how girls' brains mature much earlier, for example, one reason for the gender gap in education. But many differences are enduring. Men are typically more aggressive, take more risks, and have a higher sex drive than girls and women. Of course, this is not a comprehensive list. There are other traits that tend to be found more often in men than in women. Males are a bit more interested in things, for example, while women are a bit more interested in people. The guy tinkers in the garage, his wife chats with a friend. But these three, aggression, risk, sex, are where the differences are most pronounced and the ones I'll say more about here. In this chapter, I describe the evidence for natural sex differences, especially in terms of aggression, risk, and sex drive. I'll then argue that both our immediate environment and broader culture matter greatly as well, shaping the ways in which biological differences develop and are expressed. Occupational choice, especially the so-called STEM paradox, provides an example of the need to take both our immediate environment and the broader culture into account. Nature and nurture both matter, and they also interact in important ways. I think we can safely leave this tired debate to one side. Finally, I point to the dangers of ignoring biology altogether, especially in applied fields like psychology. The idea that there is a natural basis for sex differences is, however, politically charged, so I'd better get the caveats in right away. First, while certain traits are more associated with one sex than the other, the distributions overlap, especially among adults. After using MRI scans to examine sex differences in a sample of over 5,000 people in the UK, the largest study of its kind to date, psychologist Stuart Ritchie and his co-authors conclude that for every brain measure that showed even large sex differences, there was always overlap between males and females. Even in the case of the large difference in total brain volume, there was 48.1% sample overlap. In other words, the differences are dimorphic, different but overlapping, rather than binary. Watch for that gap instinct I mentioned in Chapter 2. The typical male has a greater willingness to take risks, for example, than the typical female, especially in adolescence. But some women are more risk-taking than some men. Most studies find the biggest differences are at the tails of these distributions rather than for the majority of people. A large majority of the most aggressive people are male, but the differences in aggressiveness in the general population are much smaller. Second, these sex differences can be magnified or muted by culture. Some cultures valorize violence, while others do not. I'm pretty sure that I would be more physically aggressive if I'd been born in Sparta a couple of thousand years ago. There's just not that much use for it at the Brookings Institution. These cultural variations matter a lot for how and how far natural tendencies are expressed in behavior. Culture and biology do not develop separately from each other, they co-evolve. Neither biology nor culture can provide the whole story, but understanding the role of biology is necessary for keeping it in its place. Luann Brizendine writes in her book, The Female Brain, "Biology does represent the foundation of our personalities and behavioral tendencies. If in the name of free will and political correctness, we try to deny the influence of biology on the brain, we begin fighting our own nature. If we acknowledge that our biology is influenced by other factors, we can prevent it from creating a fixed reality by which we're ruled. Third, these sex differences typically have a rather modest impact on day-to-day lives in the 21st century. There are now much bigger drivers of behavior, including not only culture, but personal agency. In modern societies, there is much more room, thankfully, for individuality. Breaking free of narrow definitions of what it takes to be a man or a woman is a mark of progress, both as societies and as individuals. But this does not require us to deny any natural differences, simply to address them responsibly. The neuroscientist Gina Rippon warns that a belief in biology brings with it a particular mindset regarding the fixed and unchangeable nature of human activity. But it is perfectly possible to have a belief in biology without mindlessly assuming that human nature is fixed and unchangeable, or that culture and environment are irrelevant. It is hard to find a responsible scientist who is either an outright determinist or an outright denier on the question of biology. The real debate is not about whether biology matters, but how much it does and when it does. Fourth, average sex differences do not justify the institutionalization of gender inequality. There is a fear that biology can be used to provide an intellectual foundation for sexism. This is well-founded, given our history. In the wrong hands, evidence for natural differences can indeed be used to justify oppression. But denying science altogether is not useful. The truth always comes back to bite you eventually. The rather boring truth is that masculine traits are more useful in some contexts and feminine ones in others, and neither set is intrinsically better than the other. Fifth, average differences between groups should not influence how we view individuals. That is what most people call stereotyping, and economists call statistical discrimination. Even if, on average, women are wired to be a little more nurturing, which they are, it does not mean that my son cannot be an excellent, caring, and empathetic teacher of young children, which he is. You can probably think of some women who are not very nurturing. If you're hiring into a job where nurturing is important, focus on the individual, not their sex. It's important then to keep the role of biology in perspective and to be careful to avoid potential misuse. There's always a danger of succumbing to the naturalistic fallacy, presuming that everything that's natural must necessarily be good. But nor is it helpful to deny or dismiss the reality of natural sex differences. As the anthropologist Melvin Connor writes in Women After All, "I want my daughters and sons to understand there are differences between the sexes that are not shaped by culture, but are more fundamental, rooted in evolution and biology. I don't want any of the four of them, or my hundreds of students a year, or any young people, or anyone at all, to live with the great disadvantage of missing that fact." Testosterone, aggression. It is ironic that in most of the religious creation myths, the male comes before the female. In biology, the opposite is the case. In the beginning was the female. The initial genetic plan for all humans, as for all mammals, is for a female. In an XY combination, the job of the short but industrious Y chromosome is to disrupt that carefully laid female plan. Men are basically genetically modified women, in the words of Oxford geneticist Brian Sykes. Task number one for the Y, about 7 weeks from fertilization, is to get the testes growing. Next, the embryo is subjected to a bath of the androgen testosterone, which sets it down the path towards manhood. Androgens masculinize the brain. Next, under orders from SOX9 in the Sertoli cells, a two-man team of genetic workers, AMH on chromosome 19p13.3 and AMHR2 on chromosome 12, represses the development of female reproductive body parts. The male hormones then take a break for a few years until puberty, when testosterone is needed again among other things, to grow the penis and the prostate. The whole process of sex determination is so extraordinarily complex that it is amazing it goes according to plan almost all the time. But it does. Almost all of us are born definitively male or female. Occasionally, an XX embryo gets exposed to more male hormones than usual, either as a result of a genetic anomaly or certain medications taken during pregnancy, which can lead to being defined as intersex rather than male or female. This part of the spectrum of sexual development is, as Connor puts it, like some exotic glass sculpture, small but beautiful and strange. Historically, however, intersex people themselves have been treated more as strange than beautiful, and subjected to victimization, unwanted surgery, and shame. Even today, their human rights are often violated. There is no single definition of intersex, and there are varying estimates of prevalence, but applying the broadest definition, a reasonable upper-end estimate is of around 1 in 100 people. Intersex people with more typically female anatomy are often assigned female at birth, but many are in fact more at home with a male identity, and they often transition later. This provides important evidence that sex is strongly determined by what happens in the womb rather than after birth. One result of the testosterone bath of male brains is a greater tendency towards physical aggression, not just in humans, but in almost all primates and mammals. Human males are more physically aggressive in all cultures at all ages. Boys are 5 times more likely than girls to be frequently aggressive by the age of 17. 17 months, that is. The gap widens until early adulthood before narrowing again. Worldwide, men commit over 95% of homicides and the overwhelming majority of violent acts of other kinds, including sexual assault. But the relationship between testosterone, masculinity, and aggression is complex. For one thing, it looks as if testosterone does not directly trigger aggression, but amplifies it. How far this amplification takes place depends a lot on the circumstances. As Carol Hooven shows in her book, Testosterone, the story of the hormone that dominates and divides us, the innate tendency towards aggression in boys and men is real, but not necessarily expressed. We're not slaves to ourselves. It is also important to note that most societies have become much less violent over time, and that there are big differences in crime rates among countries today. As Hooven writes, that all these factors matter is not evidence that the relationship between T and aggression is weak. Rather, it shows that it's complicated, as is the research that looks into how the relationship works. Nobody denies that culture and socialization matter. It would otherwise be difficult to explain the dramatic differences in levels of male violence between different places and in different eras. But it is equally silly to deny that biology matters here too, not least in the differences between men and women. Daredevils, risk. These sex differences are not the result of some cosmic accident. Humans are, as Desmond Morris puts it, risen apes, not fallen angels. The traits that get passed on are the ones that have been reproductively effective. That is what sexual selection is all about. The optimal reproductive strategies have been different for men and for women, with long-run consequences for our psychology. Men, for example, have a greater appetite for risk. This is not a social construct. It can be identified in every known society throughout history, as Joyce Benenson shows in her book, Warriors and Worriers, The Survival of the Sexes. As a team of scholars studying leadership styles write, sex differences exist in virtually every area in which risk has been studied, with males engaging in more risk-taking than females. Similar findings have been reported from hunter-gatherers to bank CEOs. Like aggression, risk-taking is one of the differences between male and female psychology that has clear roots in our evolutionary history. Taking risks must then make more sense for men. But why? Bluntly, because men are much less likely than women to reproduce at all. In fact, we have twice as many female ancestors as male ones. This can take a minute to get your head around, After all, genetically speaking, everyone must have a mother and a father. But of course, one man can father many children with many women, while others father none at all. This is exactly what's happened historically. Genghis Khan, a direct ancestor of 1 in 200 people today, is perhaps the most famous example. The polite way to put this is that males have higher variance in reproductive success than females. Psychologist Roy Baumeister makes the point more bluntly. To maximize reproduction, a culture needs all the wombs it can get, but a few penises can do the job. There is usually a penile surplus. Add the fact that most human societies have been polygynous, allowing men to have multiple wives, and you end up with what Harvard evolutionary psychologist Joseph Henrich calls the math problem of surplus men. This is where risk comes in. Men who are in danger of becoming evolutionary duds will be willing to take serious risks in order to gain access to a mate, perhaps by committing a crime, to get more resources or fighting in a potentially lucrative war. Even a 50-50 chance of success looks pretty good to a man who is otherwise unlikely to have any children at all. As a result, Henrich writes, men's psychology shifts in ways that spark fiercer male-male competition. Recent evidence for this claim comes from a study of China's one-child policy, which was introduced at different times in different provinces, providing a chance for researchers to examine the impact. Because families preferred to have a boy, once the rule was in place, the sex ratio tilted sharply towards males. The economist Lena Edlund shows that 18 years after the introduction of the policy in each area, as the surplus boys became men, crime rates started to rise. Not modestly either, arrest rates almost doubled. Edlund's work underlines a crucial point. Even though male psychology is more wired for risk, this usually tips into antisocial forms of risk-taking, such as crime, only in circumstances of intense competition. It hardly needs to be said that the male attitude toward risk comes with many downsides. When I look back through the eyes of a middle-aged father at some of the games my male friends and I would play as teens, I shudder. The one where we tried to be the last one to dash across a highway in front of an oncoming truck particularly stands out. I was never last. But the willingness of men to put their lives on the line also has some upsides. Men seem to demonstrate a greater willingness to take risks in order to save others, which again makes perfect evolutionary sense, given the relatively greater importance of female bodies for reproduction. Each year, the Carnegie Hero Fund, founded in 1904, issues medals to civilians for courageous acts, specifically risking their life to save a stranger. In 2021, 66 of the 71 medals awarded went to men. Medalists for that year included Lucas Silverio Mendoza, age 19, killed while attempting to guide a 3-year-old from a burning building, and 17-year-old Christian Alexander Burgos, who drowned after saving the life of a 9-year-old boy and his mother. We can seek to reduce the downsides of the greater male willingness to take risks, but also encourage and celebrate the benefits it can bring. As Margaret Mead wrote, it is essential that the tasks of the future should be so organized that as dying for one's country becomes unfeasible, taking risks for that which is loved may still be possible. As I write, however, the prospect of dying for one's country is only too real in war-torn Ukraine. Sex on the male brain. Given that the differences between male and female psychology have emerged in large part through sexual selection, perhaps it should not be a surprise that the biggest difference between men and women is with regard to sex itself. As a matter of biological fact, men are just lustier, or have what Connor labels more driven sexuality than women. A comprehensive review of 150 studies found overwhelming evidence that men have a higher sex drive, reflected in spontaneous thoughts about sex frequency and variety of sexual fantasies, desired frequency of intercourse, desired number of partners, masturbation, liking for various sexual practices, willingness to forego sex, initiating versus refusing sex, making sacrifices for sex, and other measures. As Billy Crystal's character says in the movie City Slickers, women need a reason to have sex. Men just need a place. Again, there is a good evolutionary reason for this difference. With a much higher chance of failing to father any children, men have had to be ready to take almost any opportunity for procreation. As Marianne Legato, director of the Foundation for Gender-Specific Medicine, writes, physically, men in their prime are hardwired to be in a state of near perpetual readiness to couple with any female in their environment who is likely to be able to conceive and bear children. That is why Legato and others see erectile health as a proxy for overall health in men. The commercialization of the male sex drive is as old as recorded history. There are 25 words for prostitute in Latin. It is almost entirely men who pay for sex, and there are about 1 million prostitutes working in the US today, far outnumbering priests and pastors. A study in New York found that opening a strip club or escort agency reduced sex crime in the surrounding neighborhood by 13%. More money flows through the sex trade than drugs and guns combined, according to a study of 8 cities by the Urban Institute. The reality of the male sex drive means, whether we like it or not, that sex workers will always be with us. Policymakers should recognize this fact rather than engaging in magical thinking about the prospects of a change in male sexuality. Decriminalizing prostitution would be good, not least to improve conditions for sex workers themselves. Pornography is also not new. An erotic ivory figurine discovered in 2008 dates back around 35,000 years. Every technological revolution, from the printing press to the camera and movies, means more porn. But the internet has been a force multiplier. In 2021, Pornhub and Xvideos, the two largest online porn sites, had an average of 694 million and 640 million visitors each month, respectively, in the US alone. For context, that is more than Netflix, 541 million, or Zoom, 630 million. The title of a comprehensive review undertaken for the UK's Office of the Children's Commissioner summarized the situation well. Basically, porn is everywhere. Some women watch porn too, of course, but much less than men. When the New Yorker writer and CNN commentator Jeffrey Toobin became famous for being seen masturbating in a break during a long Zoom meeting, the reaction of most of my female friends was along the lines of, what was he thinking? In the middle of a meeting? In the middle of the day? For most of the men, it was, what was he thinking? Not checking that his camera was turned off? I think that one of the reasons that porn use can cause such a strong negative reaction is that it highlights vividly the nature of male sexuality. Typically, young men report watching porn 2 or 3 days a week, almost always to accompany masturbation, and usually not for very long. 6 minutes seems to be the average visit length. Men who are in committed sexual relationships masturbate to porn much less frequently. As with gaming, the problem is among the small numbers of heavy users who may become addicted. Again, it hardly needs adding that for good or ill, culture hugely influences the expression of the driven sexuality of men. One of the most important things young men learn from their surrounding culture is how to express their sexual desire in an appropriate way. But greater male lust is a fact of life. Cultural animals. I hope to have convinced you now that while sex differences in biology are not determinative of behavior, they do matter, and that little good will come from denying it. But our environment and culture weigh heavily too. It is not nature or nurture, it is nature and nurture. We don't have a get-out-of-evolution-free card, writes Kevin Mitchell, a neurogeneticist at Trinity College Dublin. But we are also not meat robots whose behaviour is determined by the positions of a few knobs and switches, independent of any societal forces. Some of the most fascinating recent research in this area shows how our immediate environment, especially during childhood, shapes the way in which genetic predispositions are expressed. Growing up in a stressful or unstable family environment, for example, appears to influence the capacity of the brain to metabolize serotonin, which helps to reduce aggressive behavior. Differing life trajectories of identical twins influence how far genes associated with risk-taking are dampened or amplified. Children with fathers in prison see a shortening of the length of their telomeres, the ends of chromosomes, which increases the risk of health problems in adulthood. Boys with genes that make them more sensitive to their environment do worse when their biological father leaves the household, but also benefit most if their biological father joins the household. An example of how being an orchid can bring benefits as well as costs. There are countless other examples of the complex two-way relationship between physical biology and the social environment. The fact that biology matters does not make culture less important. In fact, it makes it more important. Culture determines how we manage, channel, and express many of the natural traits I've described here. Biology influences culture, but culture also influences our biology. As Joseph Henrich argues, it makes most sense to think of the co-evolution of nature and nurture. Culture rewires our brains and alters our biology, he says, without altering the underlying genetic code. When humans learned how to use fire, we started to eat more meat, for example, and our digestive systems adapted. Literacy changed the psychology of many people who became what Henrich calls weird: Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. One striking example is the role of marriage, which Henrich describes, rather brutally, as a testosterone suppression system. I've been married almost continuously for 30 years. Testosterone levels are highest among young, single men, and those with higher T are actually more likely to become fathers. But testosterone levels then fall among men who settle down with a wife and children, and the drops are sharpest among men who do more childcare. One group of scholars studying this evidence concludes that human males have an evolved neuroendocrine architecture shaped to facilitate their role as fathers and caregivers as a key component of reproductive success. There are broader social implications here too. As the institution of monogamous marriage spread, the number of men directly involved in raising families rose. The collective impact via reduced testosterone levels was to dramatically reduce overall levels of male violence. This is a good example of the complex interactions between biology, immediate environment, and broader culture. Fragile manhood. Anthropologists all agree, manhood is fragile. Womanhood is more robust because it is more determined by women's specific role in reproduction. As the feminist anthropologist Sherry Ortner writes, it is simply a fact that proportionately more of woman's body space for a greater percentage of her lifetime is taken up with the natural processes surrounding the reproduction of the species. Womanhood is defined more by biology, manhood more by social construction. This is why masculinity tends to be more fragile than femininity. When was the last crisis of femininity? That's right, never. Masculinity is defined at least as much by behavior as biology. As the British psychiatrist Anthony Clare writes in his book On Men, Masculinity in Crisis, I learned very early on what a man does is even more important than who he is. Clare was referring specifically to paid work in a modern capitalist society, but the general observation holds for almost every known human society. Manhood is a continuous achievement, rather than just a single milestone. In many cultures, rites of initiation, often involving physical duress or risk, have marked the transition from boy to man. As the American poet Leonard Krieger wrote, "In every age, not just our own, manhood was something that had to be won." But what can be won can also be lost, hence the fragility. The making of masculinity is an important cultural task in any society, especially during periods of rapid social change like our own. As the anthropologist David Gilmore writes, manliness is a symbolic script, a cultural construct. Real men do not simply emerge naturally over time like butterflies from boyish cocoons. They must be assiduously coaxed from their juvenescent shells, shaped and nurtured, counseled and prodded into manhood. This is not to suggest that there is a single blueprint for making men. To say that men have to be made does not mean there is only one set of instructions. What makes for a real man varies greatly across cultures. Human behavior is driven by a combination of nature, our instincts based in biology, nurture, the instructions we get from our surrounding culture, and agency, our personal initiative. Much of the drama of human life stems from the tension between these three forces. As Shakespeare's Coriolanus declares, "I'll never be such a gosling to obey instinct, but stand as if a man were author of himself and knew no other kin." He's trying to ignore both nature, the gosling-like instinct, as well as his social duties to his kin and just go his own way. He fails, of course. Nobody can simply break free of biology or culture to become a fully autonomous agent. Even enlightened moderns are animals underneath. All we can do is try to strike an appropriate balance. The good news is that as societies progress, first culture and then individual agency become increasingly important, the kaleidoscope of our life choices becomes more colorful. But we should not make Coriolanus's error and think we can escape our culture. We are, as Roy Baumeister argues in The Cultural Animal, evolved for culture. "Human beings are shaped, first by their genes and then by their social environment," he writes, "to live in culture." Culture has played a particularly important role in channeling the energy of men towards positive social ends, especially by teaching them to care for others. But, as Margaret Mead warned, this behavior being learned is fragile and can disappear rather easily under social conditions that no longer teach it effectively. This is a warning we should heed. The STEM paradox. I've already stressed that an average difference between groups on any given characteristic typically offers limited information about any particular individual. But aggregated across whole populations, these differences will lead to certain patterns, for example, in occupational choice. There has been a strong movement to get more girls and women into STEM careers in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It has been pretty successful, too. Women now account for 27% of workers in these occupations, a big jump from the 8% share in 1970, though still, of course, a long way from parity. But should we expect to get to 50-50 gender parity in all these jobs? Probably not. On average, remember, men are more attracted to things, women to people. Even under conditions of perfect gender equality, more men than women will likely choose these career paths, not because of sexism or socialization, but because of real differences in preferences. In 2018, two researchers, Gisbert Stoet and David Geary, showed that in more gender-equal countries, such as Finland and Norway, women were less likely to take university courses in STEM subjects. Stoet and Geary called this the gender equality paradox. They speculated that in countries with high incomes and strong welfare states, the economic incentives to pursue STEM careers may be lower, allowing women to choose courses and jobs that more closely match their personal preferences. Some related research offers support for Stoet and Geary's conclusions. Armin Falk and Johan Hermler studied sex differences in certain preferences, such as a willingness to take risks, patience, altruism, positive and negative reciprocity, and trust across a range of countries. Sex differences were largest in richer and more gender-equal countries, with each having an independent effect. They conclude that a more egalitarian distribution of material and social resources enables women and men to independently express gender-specific preferences. A similar study using different data sources came to the same conclusion. As one of the authors, Petri Kajonius, writes, "A possible explanation is that people in more progressive and equal countries have a greater opportunity to express inherent biological differences. Another theory is that people in progressive countries have a greater desire to express differences in their identity through their gender." It's important to note that none of these studies has a design allowing for a clear causal interpretation. But at the very least, this work should make us cautious about holding out for perfect gender parity in every single domain of life. Some of the differences we observe may be the result of informed personal agency, and if so, we should respect those choices. While conservatives sometimes suggest that women who don't conform to traditional roles are denying their nature, many on the left insist that women who do must be surrendering to sexism. But I think the Atlantic writer Olga Kazan gets it right. "The upshot of this research," she writes, "is neither especially feminist nor especially sad. It's not that gender equality discourages girls from pursuing science. It's that it allows them not to if they're not interested." 2 points bear repeating here. First, average differences between groups should never influence the treatment of individuals. Even if somewhat fewer women than men are interested in a job in engineering, this is no justification for discrimination against any particular woman. Second, the distributions of these attributes still substantially overlap. In one major study of sex differences on the people versus things dimension, for example, almost half, 47%, of the male and female distributions overlapped with the other. This means that a nugatory representation of either sex in a particular profession cannot plausibly be attributed to natural preferences. One fascinating study by psychologists Rong Su and James Rounds compared the proportion of women who would be expected to be in various occupations based on gender differences in interests with the actual numbers. Su and Rounds found a good match in many fields such as mathematics, with 40% representation, and the biological sciences, 45%. But there was significant underrepresentation of women in engineering. Around 30% of engineers would be female if interests alone were driving occupational choice, according to their estimates. But the actual number of women engineers was half that. At the other end of the scale, there is a heavy overrepresentation of women in the medical services field, which includes nursing. In Chapter 11, I'll argue strongly that many more men could and should be working in the health and educational sectors. Psyched. The mission of the American Psychological Association is to benefit society and improve lives. But the association failed against this benchmark with its 2018 guidelines on working with boys and men. The summary of the guidelines states that traditional masculinity, marked by stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression, is, on the whole, harmful. The APA report also describes the related problem of a masculinity ideology, defined as a particular constellation of standards that have held sway over large segments of the population, including anti-femininity, achievement, eschewal of the appearance of weakness, and adventure, risk, and violence. The association quickly came under attack from conservative critics, who said the guidelines amounted to conversion therapy, similar to that once offered to lesbian women and gay men. A clarification was tweeted. "The guidelines support encouraging positive aspects of traditional masculinity, such as courage and leadership, and discarding traits such as violence and sexism, while noting that the vast majority of men are not violent." This was false. The guidelines contain not a single reference to these positive aspects of masculinity. some people on the political right overreacted, perhaps. But there is no question that the APA put out a bad document. The guidelines fail to recognise any biological basis at all for male psychology. Testosterone, for example, is not mentioned. As far as the APA is concerned, it seems, masculinity is entirely socially constructed. As the report states, by the time he reaches adulthood, a man will tend to demonstrate behaviours as prescribed by his ethnicity, culture, and different constructions of masculinity. The complete absence of biology here contrasts with the association's equivalent report on girls and women, which usefully discusses the potential psychological implications of puberty, childbirth, and menopause. So while girls and women are treated as flesh and blood, boys and men are treated as blank slates. This is obviously absurd, but it is also damaging, not least because of the poor guidance it gives to psychologists, 80% of whom are women, as they seek to help boys and men. The APA is not the only institution that seems to have developed something of a science aversion when it comes to sex and biology. In 2015, the MacArthur Foundation issued a 47-page report on the implications of the latest science on adolescent development for juvenile justice. The report correctly drew attention to racial disparities. But despite the huge differences between adolescent girls and boys in terms of brain development, especially with regard to risk-taking and aggression, the report made not a single reference to sex or gender. The fear of sex determinism seems in these cases to have led to an unwillingness to engage with or even acknowledge the evidence for natural influences on behaviour. When this blinkered approach is taken by professional bodies or research institutions, things have gone badly awry. Dances and shipwrecks. J.F. Roxburgh, the first headmaster of Stowe School, a private boys' school in England, described his goal as cultivating men who would be acceptable at a dance and invaluable in a shipwreck. He wanted men who could make the kind of sacrifices made by the awardees of the Carnegie Hero Medals. Perhaps he had in mind the heroism of many men on the Titanic, which famously sank in 1912, with a survival rate of just 19% for the male passengers compared to 75% for women. But the first half of Roxburgh's formulation is even more important. Men who are acceptable at a dance are those who've learned how to conduct themselves in company, how to treat women respectfully and as equals. They are, in short, mature. One of the primary functions of human culture is to help young people to become responsible, self-aware adults. Maturity means, among many other things, an ability to calibrate your behaviour in a way that renders it appropriate to the circumstances. To be a grown-up means learning how to temper our own natures. We learn to go to the bathroom. We learn not to hit each other when we're upset. We learn not to act on impulse. We learn empathy, restraint, reflection. It takes time, at least a couple of decades. It takes boys a little longer than girls. But most of us manage it in the end. Boys become men, even gentlemen. The boy is still with us. He's just not in charge anymore.